welcome this morning to this hour. As you can tell by the bulletin, a different format will be followed this Sunday. We'll also use a similar format next Sunday. Instead of a sermon embedded in the service, I will speak to you first, and then the response, our joint response, will be the act of worship. The first thing I want to say to you this morning is congratulations, new community. You probably have not checked the calendar lately, but you have made it 52 months. Researchers at the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, however, are not encouraging for us. They conducted a study of 1,000 church plants in 12 denominations and networks. And what they discovered is that 99% of them survived the first year, 92% the second year, 81% the third year, and only 68% the fourth. Which leaves me wondering, what about year five? Our odds of continuing seem to be decreasing, not increasing. And so give it to a straight doc. We can take it. We're grown-ups. How much longer do we have? I mean, can you at least give us a 50-50 chance of making it in the fifth year? What's the prognosis, the long-term projection? Now, according to this same research, there are four factors that are vital for survivability. First, having a parent or sponsor group. An association, an established congregation, somebody who can give you resources, support you, give you guidance, and that the planter, the pastor, also has a peer group of planters, supporters, and so forth. You can't do it alone. That's number one. Number two, putting in place a proactive fundraising plan. Three, focusing on leadership development training. And four, by far the most important for success, managing expectations. You see, people start out with great energy and hope. The more realistic they are about what's going to happen or what they're going to face, the joys and the burdens, the losses, the sacrifices, the gains, the more likely they are to hang in there. The more realistic they are, the more likely they're going to survive. And of course, everyone comes in with a preconception of what this is going to be. And they bring it from what they've always known. We've all known congregations. And that's what it's supposed to be like in our minds. That's what it's supposed to do. And the closer the new start matches that conception, fits what one has grown up with, then the more likely members will hang in there and continue. And finally, a new start, and this is being honest, cannot expect too much from those who are involved. And yet at the same time, everything is expected of it. It is expected that this new start will keep everybody interested and involved and will meet their needs. Or slowly by the third, the fourth, the fifth year, they'll begin to fade, begin to peel away, and go somewhere else to get what they want. What's missing. When I read this report about this research, I thought to myself, goodness, we're doomed. We haven't done any of these things. We have to be the worst congregation in the history of church planning. But on second thought, I really don't remember us setting out to plant a church. Do you? I don't remember any demographic studies, no strategic planning sessions, no searching for our target audience or the proper location or anything like that. And besides, I'm not a church planner. And to be honest with you, I have never had the slightest inkling of anything close to a notion of calling or interest or desire to lead or ever be part of a new church start. If you had said to me, new church start, I would have been in the opposite direction. So what are we doing here? If we didn't set out to do this, and we're not equipped to do this, and what is it? What is this that we're part of? Before I offer an answer, I must tell you that when I look at you, I have the deepest, fullest sense of gratitude. I look at each of your faces and I admire you. I respect you. Before, in a large sea of people in a sanctuary, it was a crowd. And I knew many of you fairly well, some more than others. I knew all of them. But to know you now and to see you more face to face, I have the greatest respect for you. You will always, in my memory, in my book, be one of those who took the risk. You didn't have to do this. You had plenty of other options, and you still do. You could have stayed and hunkered down with your friends in the little corner of your special Sunday school class in the midst of a large congregation hoping for better days, because that's what the vast majority did. The vast majority. You could have left and gone to another well-established, full-bodied congregation. Or go to one of the startups that are popping up everywhere these days. Everywhere. And there were many who did that. You also could have just left the church, period, and joined the ranks of the nuns. That's not N-U-N-S. That's N-O-N-E-S. That is the latest, greatest, and largest spiritual movement in the United States today. Everybody migrating in groves away from the church, quitting organized religion. Those who still claim to be Christian, but now they're churchless. That's the new fashion. Or you could have spent some time here with us, and as soon as the new car smell wore off, you could have moved on to one of the above options, which are still viable for you. And there have been those who've done that. And yet, you're here. You didn't do that. You're still here. Beth and I had the same options as you. Although staying in the congregation where we were, as you understand, was not one of them. I could have left and gone to another established congregation. I have the years of experience and the ability, as well as the broad ministerial network, to make that happen. I also could have joined the nuns. I could have just dropped out. I think I have spent enough time with institutional religion and local congregations to last a lifetime. Or I could have retired. Trust me, after 40 years of carrying the usual ministerial strains and then constant beatings in the last couple of those years, that option had the siren call of heaven itself. I thought I heard the angels. But it's obvious I did not go any of those ways. Theology would not let me. God has favored me beyond measure and deserving with a lifetime vocation of Christian study and learning. And now those teachings, those doctrines have such a firm hold on me. In other words, I actually believe this stuff. I believe in the gospel. I believe in the church. And I believe that the church is not optional but necessary for the mission of God and thus for Christian existence in this world. I cannot leave and not be part of the community that is formed by the faith around Jesus Christ. But I'll also tell you, I cannot go back to the typical, the common, the nominal that I have been in part of my entire life. I cannot and will not go back. And I certainly have no patience for the hip Christianity of the perpetual youth group that's called the Contemporary Church. And you have to realize that puts me in quite a quandary. Thanks theology, I appreciate that very much. I don't know if you remember this or even knew it, but a little over 5 years ago, I prepared a paper on the church. Specifically, it was a set of 12 talking points because I wanted to change the conversation of the congregation. I wanted to change what we were always talking about, which is all that I've ever heard any congregation ever talking about. I wanted to talk about something else. What I wanted to talk about is a serious statement, a serious understanding of who we are and why we're here and what we're about the gospel. Not off the top of our heads what we think the church is or would like it to be, not what the majority feel and have as a preference, and not what our culture would consider relevant, but what is the church historically, biblically, theologically speaking? And I wanted to speak about that. I wanted to have a discourse of the church in relation to the history of God's revelation and redemption made known supremely and definitively in Jesus Christ that has been born to in the scriptures and in the saints. Well, that got people talking. Just not about the church, but about me. Why don't you do your job? You're the CEO. You need to do what a CEO does, which is focus us on what really matters, run this business, and make it successful. You need to tell us how to get our name out there, highlight our great music ministry, support it with a wide variety of goods and services, first-rate, exciting programs, ranging from spiritual exercises to jazzercise, from social services to travel services, from friendship groups to support groups for all ages, where people can enjoy relationships, can get involved, and they can receive good practical advice for everyday living, feel good about themselves, have their needs met, meet the needs of others, and hopefully in the process, make this a better world. This has to be a religious mall, a family life center, sports club, daycare, match.com, therapy groups, social services agency, corporate headquarters, all rolled into one if we're to bring in more members, especially young people and young couples with young children, and if we're going to survive and be a great church. I listened to that. I actually heard it over the years, increasingly so. That was every conversation going on in congregations, business meetings, committee meetings, so forth. And I actually listened and took them up on it in my pastor's class, in the pulpit, on retreats with the staff and with the deacons. I talked about the great church. Not a great church according to our spiritual gifts and strategic plans and best practices, but the great church, according to our own faith tradition. How to discover what that means, how to be true to that, if that's what we are, as we claim to be, and what it really means. Because I think that's what really, really matters. And you all know how that turned out, that conversation. When I found myself on the outside, I had an opportunity to take some time to think back over what I had heard on the inside. That what I was talking about, where did you get that? We've never heard that. We've been in church our entire lives, and we don't know where you're getting all of that stuff. Now, you don't believe in the Bible. You don't believe in missions. You don't like children. Don't give us the textbook, the theoretical. This is practical. We're the real church. And all you're talking about is the ideal. And all churches are striving for the ideal, but they all fall short because they're all made up of human beings who are sinners and they're not perfect. And so there is no perfect church, but that's the beauty of it. Because if you don't like the church where you are, and by the way, they're all churches. So you get your choice. And it's a matter of personal choice and preference. If you don't like the one where you are, you just go shopping for another church. It's called church shopping. And you can find one, or you can find several and mix and match. You'll get something from one and something from another. You can do that. Or you can go and start your own if you don't like any of the ones you find. Besides, what you're talking about is back then when this is now. That's what people used to think and believe. We're in a different time. We have to rethink Christianity. We have to reinvent the church to fit the times we live in. It has to be something people can immediately understand and believe in and want to be part of. I thought about all of that. All of that that I had heard. And you can already guess my response, which is, I didn't buy any of it. Never had and never would. I think it's a bunch of hogwash, to be honest with you. Because as I've told you, theology will not let me believe that. Because I believe theology. Our theology. Not something I'm making up, but just something that's been there. It is there. The congregations have lost it. And so I began to wonder, and it was a struggle. Even to the point at times on the precipices of despair, is the historic biblical theological church, which, by the way, is real. It's a debate over what you think is real. But is that even possible anymore? Is it possible for folks who live in a culture that's been marinating for 500 years in a special blend of modern rationalism, humanism, romanticism, naturalism, individualism, hyperpluralism, relativism, secularism, and now throw into the whole mix postmodern nihilism, is it possible for people who live in this kind of culture to be Christians? Not in name, not in what they create that to be, but Christians. Is that possible? And I take that very seriously. This is a whole different place we're in. Is it possible any longer for people to be captured by the gospel when they're under captivity to just about anything and everything else? And is it possible for a group of people to come together solely because of that gospel? Only for that gospel. And if that gospel is not there, they have no reason to be and they won't be. Is that even possible in today's time? Is it possible for us to hear the grand narrative centered in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Christ and enter its world, take on its distinctive frame of reference and interpretation, allow it to give us a totally new identity and purpose, a radically different alternative way of coming at things and living our lives? Is that possible? Is it possible that we would turn and reorient in reference to God's disclosure of truth and salvation in Jesus Christ? And in continuity with the early church, the apostles, the prophets, and the patriarchs? Is it even possible for people as they are today to understand this? And accept it, what I've just said, or even care? Let me put it on a more street level. Is it possible for busy, on-the-go people to have time for any of this? Or is that just simply asking too much? That's the question with which I continue to struggle seriously and deeply. Is it possible? What is possible for people with the support of a sponsor, a proactive fundraising plan, leadership development, training, and the management of expectations is to plant another congregation and get in the game and be in competition with all the other congregations and new starts. That is possible. It is possible to track cultural trends, survey to find what people want, what will sell, then find a way to give it to them. It is possible to be people-centered, and therefore to help people cope with their tough everyday lives, very complicated and confused, to enhance their self-esteem and live more productively and motivate them for the week ahead. That is very possible. It is possible to turn faith into religion or politics or social justice causes or humanitarian social projects. It is possible to offer enough goods and services, enough personal encouragement and enjoyment, along with enough spiritual exercises and experiences of God and emotional expressions to bring in enough people to raise enough money to pay for all of this and have enough left over to build another building, hire more staff, offer more goods and services, and bring in more people. It is possible to focus on performance. How's it working? Or to focus on results. How are we doing? To make the top agenda satisfying the consumer. Is everybody happy? I remember not too long ago, one young minister came up to me and he said, I'm just discovering that my number one job is to keep everybody happy. And I said, yes, welcome to the ministry today. Just don't do it. Be the one you've been called to be. And do what you've been called to do. Which is your representative, your witness of the gospel. Not everybody was happy with Jesus. This has become the dominant default paradigm of congregations of all types and sizes everywhere. I go into small congregations. I preached a revival series 2 years ago in a small congregation in this part of town. And the thing that they struggle with most there is, how do we be this? How do we compete with all the others and with what's going on in people's lives today? And so I preached 5 sermons on don't do it. Once you do it, once you buy into it, you can't get out. And you'll think that is the Christian church. And the reason it is the default paradigm is because it is possible. It is something we humans know something about and can conceive of and can do. And it's fairly easy. You can do it fairly quickly and pull it together and pull it off. Because it's possible, and everybody goes after it. But the church, that's another story. The biblical theological story. And according to that, the conception and creation of the church belongs to God. And God alone. It is possible for us to move a movement, or gather a gathering, or organize an organization. That's why we rush to do those things. They're all human constructions. And they all can be good. And even necessary. But it is impossible for us to make of any of those things the church. That's like trying to take coal and change it somehow into gold. Can't do it. It is God who sends the church. Just as God sent his spirit to the void and there was creation of the world, God sent his son in the power of that same spirit and word, and there was the inbreaking of the eschatological kingdom. Only the initiative of divine will, grace, and power sends the church into the world. Then, throughout history, and today. Because God is the inventor, not us. God is the architect and the contractor, not us. God defines what the church is and what it's for, not us. God decides when and how to gather human beings from out of the world and use them like building materials. We're not the builders, we're the materials. We're the cinder block and the boards and the bricks and the nails. And assemble these pieces together in such a way that they will appear as a house or a temple or a body or a plant. God did that with Israel. He called into existence this hodgepodge who otherwise would not have any existence. And he made them his people when they otherwise, they weren't people. They were slaves, less than people. This isn't about God entering into our lives and helping us with our projects and making things better. This is about being invited out of our projects and into God's project. Not so much to help him as God sure is lucky that we're here that we can now help him pull this thing off and make it work and spread it. But rather, we are invited in so that we can be the servants. We can be used as the building materials. God is making a present living sign, foretaste, instrument, and means that we will never comprehend and we certainly will not control. You can't measure it with statistics like a yardstick. You cannot measure it with your feelings. Don't trust those, and you cannot measure with your impressions. It's God's work, where God is making his sovereignty, his mission of reuniting, restoring, and redeeming heaven and earth. He's making a dwelling place here for that to be made known. And somehow, by the great mystery of God's grace and power, bringing it about. Is largely hidden to us, even though it takes place in and through and as us. And so the church as the church is not free to be what we want it to be, all things to all people. The church isn't free to entertain whatever idea, attitude, value, or practice is current. The church isn't free to take up any good cause, and there are a lot of great causes. The church isn't free to strip away the very things that give it its distinctive identity and mission and power and purpose. For the church is not a human construction. It's a theological creation. The great 20th century theologian and ethicist Reinhold Niebuhr had a unique term that I'm going to borrow. Impossible possibility. The church is that impossible possibility. As such, given what it is impossible. That's where we begin. If we don't begin there, we'll get completely wrong. And yet, God makes it possible and actual. It is real, and it does happen. And I believe I have lived long enough to see it happen. Now, I need to tell you, I'm not one of those people who finds a penny on the ground and thinks it dropped out of heaven from a departed loved one. And I don't interpret every coincidence or good fortune as a miracle, or see God in the flutter of every leaf. But I did begin to wonder what you and I experienced. I did begin to wonder, is there something going on here that's greater? And some days I said, nah, this is just simply a conflict. And then other days I said, no, it's a different kind of conflict. It's greater. I began to see that the more the church theological was put forth, began to see inexplicable resistance and even anger increase. Why? It's the church. And yet I also began to see others perking up and coming closer, being drawn in. I became convinced that what I was experiencing and witnessing was what Paul describes in Romans 8. The whole creation groaning in travail like a woman in labor pains, causing us who are waiting for adoption and redemption to groan inwardly at ourselves. But in this hope, we are saved. People being saved, and the church being born and delivered. So, how could I move on to something else? It's just getting good. I mean, I can't walk away and join the churchless nuns. This might be the church for which those people say there is none. And I certainly cannot retire until I have first seen for myself what happens and how it turns out. Whether what has been going on and is going on really, really is the church. Not just another false alarm. And either it is or it isn't. And that's not up to us. You know, it's not like we're going to have to make this the church. It either is the church or it isn't. It's not what we make of it. It's what it makes of us. I've got to see if it can do that. I've got to see whether you and I can be taken back to our origins and reoriented, given our bearings from tradition and not from the popular culture. Whether we can take back that faith tradition that has been sold to the highest bidder. And whether we can once again have a community that is about truth and not results. It's not a program-centered or even people-centered, but that the people and the programs result from the gospel-centered community. I have to see if we'll take it seriously. Will we listen to it? Will we put out the effort that is needed, realizing how vital this is? Here's the big one. Will we be able to resist that constant temptation like an addict has to go back to what we've always known? And that our family members and friends all talk about and applaud is that nobody seems to be able to understand. Goodness, we don't fully understand. Will we be capable of being the church and be faithful? I have to find out. I have great hope. I truly do. But I have to find out whether the impossible possibility is indeed possible. Last month I was at a meeting at a church in Alexandria. And before the meeting I was standing off to the side drinking a cup of coffee, and a person came up to me whom I had met earlier in September. And actually, I met her upstairs in this building when we were together at a Virginia Baptist meeting. I remembered her name, and I called it, but she asked me for mine to remember my face. And then she said, to strike up a conversation, she said, "You're a pastor, aren't you, if I remember?" And I said, "Yes, I am. What's the name of your church?" And I told her. "What kind of church is it?" I was tempted to say, "What do you mean, what kind?" I don't think there is but just one kind, but I knew what she meant. But before I could say anything, she jumped back in. "Well," she said, I remember now, "you are in a church plant, aren't you? A break-off, a splinter group of another congregation. Well, how's that going? Which model are you following? Missional, postmodern, millennial, free grace, convergence, emergent? Are you growing?" Now, I wish I had this message ready at that time, and I could just maybe hand it to her to get a little more background and explanation. But what I said was, "No, none of those things. We really don't think of ourselves in that way, not even as a church plant, a new start, none of that. We don't even think of that. It's theological. We're just simply learning what it means to be the church, theologically, and trying to let that give us an existence when we otherwise wouldn't have one, and to give us a name, give us a reason to be, give us a purpose." The look on her face was almost, not quite, but almost worth the stress of driving up I-95 at the Belt Lane in Virginia to get there and find a parking space. I hope, as I stand before you, You will never lose that look. Stunned silence. Utter incomprehension and disbelief. We have found ourselves encountered by a mystery that is other than and greater than ourselves, that stretches not only across the ages, but into eternity. We've been claimed and dealt with and delivered in ways that we didn't claim and deal with and deliver ourselves, and that we cannot explain, and are being taken somewhere we never thought we would be, and we still don't know where that is. We don't even know where we are. And given a heritage that seems strangely familiar, but we really don't know it, even though it's our own. It's kind of like that look that children would have entering into, as you read in C.S. Lewis's Narnia, a series of books, it's like children entering into another kingdom. And Jesus said, that's what it'll be like. You have to be like one of those children to enter. Children who are just fascinated, intrigued and lured to no end, like the Bethlehem shepherds and the Eastern Magi, who leave what they're tending to because they just got to go and see what is coming to pass. Or the ancient shepherd named Moses, who had to find out what is it about this bush that's causing it to burn, but it's not being consumed. And it was a trap. He got caught and captured to where he could not be and could not do anything else. And yet he had no conception in the world that any of this was possible. You remember his protest. And even in the wilderness, he was just, this can't be possible. Not with these people. It can't amount to anything. Having no clue that he was part of, he was in the whirlwind of the rarest opportunity. An extraordinary adventure that no human force can bring about. We'll finish next Sunday. But let's pause here. And let's worship. Praise God.